The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today on the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. The FBI investigation of President Trump goes under the microscope.
I think they rashly drew the conclusion that they finally had a potential crime against him.
We look at the politics in the agency.
The FBI has become this all-powerful agency run by rogue officials careening dangerously out of control.
Later, John Bolton on our Middle East ally.
President Trump is a very strong supporter of Israel's right to self-defense.
And Dennis Prager talks education.
A lot of the public schools of this country are ruining this country because they've been taken over by the left, and everything the left touches, it ruins.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. On January 11th, the New York Times report opened with these words, quote, "In the days after President Trump fired James B. Comey as FBI director, law enforcement officials became so concerned by the president's behavior that they began investigating whether he had been working on behalf of Russia against American interests, according to former law enforcement officials and others familiar with the investigation," end quote. Say what you will about Donald Trump, but the idea that he is a mole in the White House working for the Russians is a mighty stretch, even for the New York Times. I discussed the topic with Andrew McCarthy, columnist for National Review. If Donald Trump is a Russian mole like Kiss, he's the worst one ever. So how did this FBI talk themselves into this?
Well, I guess I'd say two things, Hugh. You know, number one, they were wrong. And number two, I'm hesitant to talk about the FBI as if it were, a singular monolithic institution. It's 35,000 people. For the most part, they're the salt of the earth. But, you know, they have a hierarchy just like everybody else does. And I think there came a point in time when the hierarchy was enmeshed in politics, not necessarily because they wanted to be, just because they were dealing with a couple of investigations that necessarily thrust them into the 2016 election. And I don't think they handled it all that well. And there were people who were running the FBI and who were running the Obama Justice Department who had a particular anathema toward Donald Trump. That's just a fact. I think that they were inclined to believe that he was a corrupt, principle-free guy, and that when they got the Steele dossier at the FBI, which was, putting aside that it was a product of the Clinton campaign, the source of it, Christopher Steele, was somebody who they regarded highly because he had provided them with important cooperation in the FIFA soccer investigation, which was the Obama administration's marquee racketeering global prosecution. So he came to them with a lot of credibility, and he had a story that fit their preconception of Donald Trump. So I think it was like pushing on an open door.
Andrew, I want to reiterate something you just said. I was honored to work with the FBI under two attorney generals in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act special assistant slot when they would bring us warrants to track Russian spies. So they were the best. They still are the best. And this is about a half dozen people to maybe a dozen people at the top of the bureau. But it's very troubling. And I have yet to be able to answer the question, did they consult Rod Rosenstein, who would be their superior here because the attorney general was recused? Have you figured out yet whether Andrew McCabe and his colleagues who launched this investigation into a sitting president sought the necessary permission from the department to which they answer?
I, of course, don't know the answer to that any more than you do, but it seems to me inconceivable that they didn't. Let's just think about this as a matter of common sense. we've heard reporting that Rosenstein came to McCabe and discussed with him the possibility of wiring up against the president and even potentially invoking the 25th Amendment. If you think that he would do that but not consult with them about opening a case, that's like saying the guy would rob the bank but he wouldn't jaywalk. I mean, opening the case was much less of a consequential matter than some of the stuff that they were talking about, number one. And number two, the point I try to make in the column that you kindly mentioned that appeared on Fox over the weekend is that this was an investigation that was always in some measure about Donald Trump. I'm not saying it wasn't about Russian interference in the election, but Trump was a part of it from the middle of the 2016 election on, and they were clearly hoping to make a case on him. And it seems to me that once they had this sort of 1-2 punch of Comey's firing and Comey's leaking of the memo about Trump trying to weigh in on the Flynn investigation, I think they rashly drew the conclusion that they finally had a potential crime against him, that is to say, obstruction. And what we see happen in those 9 days in May, going from May 9th when Comey is fired to May 17th when Bob Mueller is appointed as special counsel, is for the first time basically a prosecutor gets assigned to the case. And I think they did that because they knew they were in criminal investigation mode. It seems to me inconceivable that the FBI didn't discuss this with Rosenstein, because everything they did in that 9 days is consistent with a joint conclusion being drawn that there was now at least a basis for a criminal investigation. But I think the Justice Department knew mainly a lot of the reasons that are laid out in Bill Barr's excellent memo that he sent to the Justice Department, that the theory of obstruction that they were pursuing was legally very problematic. So I think they still carried it and fudged it under counterintelligence because they weren't ready to plant their feet entirely on obstruction. But I did think they had, or they thought they may have had, the basis for a criminal case, and they appointed a prosecutor.
Greg Jarrett, attorney and Fox News legal analyst, joined my friend and colleague Dennis Prager for more on the story.
I accept the fact of the corruption of some of the elite parts of the United States government, including the FBI leadership, CIA, Department of Justice, and the like. One of the handful of people who knows all of this extremely well, he's Fox News legal scholar Greg Jarrett. Thanks for coming on.
Dennis, my pleasure. Always great talking to you.
When I said to my audience just now, I accept the fact, et cetera, et cetera, is that a fair statement?
It is. And, you know, this New York Times story is the latest proof that senior leadership at the FBI was corrupt and dishonest. And the notion of Trump as a covert Russian agent is ludicrous on its face. Their launching of the probe was an egregious abuse of power because, Dennis, they had no probable cause, no evidence, no reasonable suspicion. The FBI has become this all-powerful agency run by rogue officials careening dangerously out of control. And this is what happens when you give an agency unfettered authority, accountable to nobody. They become ruthless, abusive, and corrupt.
Shocking. That is a shocking consequence of power that is not limited. If anybody knows this, you know this, but I'm not sure you know this. When did this begin? Was there a point when the FBI became political?
Yeah, I think it developed slowly but inexorably in the leadership of Barack Obama's Department of Justice, first with Eric Holder, then Loretta Lynch, and it seeped into the FBI under the leadership of James Comey and his confederates, Andrew McCabe, Lisa Page, Peter Strzok, James Baker, James Rebicki, all of the people that have either been fired or left in advance of being fired. But this is, you know, this is what happened. They had a preferred candidate, Dennison, you know, with Hillary Clinton. And they couldn't abide by the notion that Donald Trump won. And they became even angrier when he fired their own James Comey, even though it was for just cause. And so they decided to take action. And they, in an act of vengeance for the firing of Comey, they began this counterintelligence investigation as if he was a puppet of the Kremlin and Vladimir Putin, which, again, is preposterous, and they had no evidence of it. But they did it, Dennis, because they could.
Didn't the Democrats have anger at Comey? Because the, they also contend that he threw the election.
That's right. Immediately after Comey, under duress, by the way, reopened the Hillary Clinton case just before the election, every Democrat in Washington was howling that Comey should be fired or impeached. The irony, as you point out, is lost on nobody here.
Right. So they weren't in love with Comey. They were in love with using Comey's firing as a pretense to investigate the president.
That is absolutely right. And they knew that they couldn't just come out and say, you know, we're investigating the president as a Russian agent because we're angry at him. So they had to come up with a pretext. So they invented one, obstruction of justice. And they accused Trump of trying to impede the FBI's collusion investigation based on a couple of comments he made. But a rigorous reading of those comments shows the president was not trying to obstruct anything at all. So it was a...
You mean like, will you be loyal to me?
Yeah. Or, as the New York Times pointed out, the letter he wrote to Comey saying, thank you for telling me three times that I'm not personally being investigated for Trump-Russia collusion. Now, how is that obstruction of justice? Only in a twisted, contorted mind could it be.
When James Comey said, you are not being investigated, was he telling the truth?
He said he was. He was asked this during his testimony before Congress. And he
I didn't understand your answer. He said he was what?
He said he was telling the truth to the president that Trump was not being personally investigated.
Right.
He was not the subject of the investigation.
Oh, okay.
And Trump begged him, please put this out publicly.
Right.
Because
right.
You know, I'm getting beat up over this.
Right.
And Comey, who wanted to, you know, keep his shoe leather on the neck of Trump, refused to do it.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Go to Town Hall Review for the rest of that discussion and sign up for our podcast. You'll get the best of talk radio every day. Coming up.
President Trump is a very strong supporter of Israel's right to self-defense.
Ambassador John Bolton, when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Recently, I had the privilege of traveling to Israel and Turkey with President Trump's National Security Advisor, John Bolton. Tensions are high in the Middle East, where Iran has military forces in Syria and vows to remain, despite Israel's series of attacks on those forces. Bolton joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show, and we got right into the meat of the conversation. In your extensive conversations with Prime Minister Netanyahu and your counterparts in Israel, as well as the security services there, did you discuss Israel's strikes at the Iranian Revolutionary Guard emplacements and weapons in Syria and whether President Trump supported Israel's right to conduct those strikes?
Yes, we had extensive discussions on that, really continuing the conversations we've had for a long time. President Trump is a very strong supporter of Israel's right to self-defense. We've supported them right across the board as Iran has tried to arm elements of the Syrian regime and the Hezbollah terrorists with increasingly sophisticated missiles that can hit targets all over Israel and put the very existence of the Israeli state in jeopardy. So this is obviously an existential question for the Israelis and one that we regard with utmost seriousness.
You're a former U.N. ambassador and now the National Security Advisor. Have you discussed with President Trump and or Prime Minister Netanyahu Israel's right under Article 51 of the U.N. Charter to strike at the source of those soldiers of the IRGC and the weapons they are sending to Hezbollah?
Sure. You know, Prime Minister Netanyahu and I are both members of the Union of Former U.N. Ambassadors. We have a lot of connection on that score. And for your listeners, of course, Article 51 in the U.N. Charter embodies what the text of the charter calls the inherent right of individual and collective self-defense. And that's something we have stressed over and over again for Israel. You know, I know you're familiar with the saying people often call Israel the canary in the mine shaft when it comes to the United States, that people would like to criticize Israel or constrain Israel's options, both for its own sake and because they know ultimately it's the same argument to limit America's ability to defend itself. So we're very interested in maintaining that unfettered right Israel has, and the UN Charter itself calls it the inherent right of individual and collective self-defense.
You said in your joint appearance with Prime Minister Netanyahu at his home in Jerusalem that Iran's strategic goal of acquiring nuclear weapons capable of being delivered has not changed. Did you and he discuss how to deter that strategy or destroy the ability to make it happen?
Well, you know, we had very extensive discussions on that because I think Prime Minister Netanyahu feels that threat from Iran is really the most serious threat that Israel faces. So a lot of things I can't talk about, obviously, in public, but President Trump, I think, has made it clear publicly on any number of occasions how concerned he is about the proliferation of nuclear weapons, whether it's North Korea, Iran, or anybody else. And he's a strong believer in taking steps with Israel and others in the region who are like-minded to make sure Iran never gets to that point.
Is President Trump open to a strike on Iran's nuclear facilities if Tehran again begins to creep close to a nuclear breakout?
Well, I wouldn't want to get into specifics, as you might imagine. I think the president looks at all his options constantly. As I say, on a subject of this seriousness, this is something we coordinate very closely with Israel on, but for reasons I'm sure you can understand, we have to keep our cards close to the vest.
The teachers of Los Angeles Unified began the week on the picket lines. The second largest district is now on strike for only the second time in 30 years. It is a controversial district in a controversial state, and the latest look at the proposed curriculum is nothing short of shocking. Dennis Prager explains.
I want you to hear what kids will be learning if they embrace in California the new program for health education from kindergarten. Dispelling myths about gender expectations in kindergarten can lay the groundwork for acceptance, inclusiveness, and an anti-bullying environment in schools, the proposed framework states. Gender nonconformity and physical characteristics are often at the root of many forms of bullying. So if you see what looks like a girl and you imply that it's a girl, you might be bullying just by doing that because that girl might think that she is a boy. I'm not mocking that. I am merely stating what is being done here. Look, they are trying to destroy male and female as distinctive things. All right, please understand that. That will now become normative in California public schools. It is time for Americans who are sick of this, and it's not only conservatives, to take their kids out of those public schools. Either homeschool the child or pay for a religious education or do so or start a charter school. This is more important than your kid, what college your kid goes to, which is the preoccupation of most parents. What elementary school your kid goes to, what high school your kid goes to, will ultimately be more significant. Chapter 3, the transitional kindergarten through grade 3. So what are these myths about gender that even, this is the article, that even kindergartners must unlearn? Not just the color toy and activity preferences the two sex tend to be attracted to, but, quote, stereotypes, unquote, that involve dress and body parts. In other words, if a boy wears a skirt to school, that is just fine. It's to be embraced. I would not have a school embrace that. I think that a school will declare girls will wear X, boys will wear X. I have been for school uniforms my entire life. It is another one of the idiocies that comes from the left and even liberals, that it doesn't matter what kids wear to school. You know why? Because there's no wisdom on the left. They are so confident of their wisdom that all preceding insights into children are rejected. We will discover anew. This is the conceit and the arrogance, self-righteousness that permeates the left. A lot of the public schools of this country are ruining this country because they've been taken over by the left, and everything the left touches, it ruins. Everything. There is no exception of which I am aware. The framework encourages teachers to read students books like My Princess Boy. This is K to 3. You with me? Why, and that alone would not invalidate you sending your child to school. Do you not think this is important? About a boy who likes pink dresses and to invite adults who identify as transgender to the class as guest speakers. It gets worse the more you hear about this. The framework recommends a kindergarten to third grade book on gender identity titled Who Are You?, which introduces kids to the gender spectrum. According to the lesson plan for the book, kids get to work the three layers of the gender wheel and learn how, quote, grown-ups look at a baby's body when they are born and make a guess. You hear that? Do you hear this, what they're being taught? Why aren't science teachers up in arms about this? We make a guess as to the sex of a child when it's born? It's a guess? This is the sex assigned at birth. This is the language. Sex is assigned. You hear that? Nature hasn't assigned it. Humans have assigned it.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
It took, you know, disillusionment, soul searching, me becoming a person of faith, for me to finally see what the Democrats were doing to black people and other Americans.
Carol Swain when the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Carol Swain is the founder and president of Be the People Project. She was a professor of political science and law at Vanderbilt University. She's also conservative and black. And it's that combination that has some people strangely upset. She spoke with Salem host Dennis Prager.
So you have quite a journey there. I mean, a black Southern woman's journey to freedom. So where did you begin? What were you...
I can tell you about the ebook. People approach me all the time, and they want to know how it is that I became a Republican. And I decided to write something, you know, for the people that were asking me. And when I started thinking about it, I really had to think hard because I didn't know why I was a Democrat, you know, all of my life. And I realized that, you know, it's very complicated, but I understand now why so many blacks are in the Democratic Party and just how hard it is to break free.
Good. So then, in a nutshell, explain that. I'm asked all the time, why are so many Jews on the left? And I have, they're very different answers, I think, with blacks and Jews. Given the utter failure of the Democratic Party to improve the lives of blacks as mayors, congressmen, etc., why do blacks keep voting Democrat?
I believe that it goes back to the Civil Rights Acts of the 1960s and the fact that Lyndon Johnson signed those acts. And in my ebook, I talk about having been born and raised in Virginia, Virginia was a state of massive resistance to integration, and that resistance was led by the Democratic machine. And in 1969, when the first Republican was elected, that Republican sent his children to predominantly black public schools in Richmond, Virginia, and he started opening up opportunities for blacks. And so in Virginia, I hadn't thought about this until I started the e-book. Opportunities for blacks came in 1969 when the first Republican was elected and the good white people of Virginia elected a Republican, the first one since Reconstruction, because they did not like what the Democrats were doing.
It's almost fair to say nobody knows this.
Yes, and, you know, like a lot of people, it's almost like a habit, and when you look and you see the black politicians, they all seem to be Democrats, and for people that are not paying attention and they just see the black leaders who look like them out there, you know, criticizing Republicans, it's easy to believe what they're saying, even though they're quite dishonest.
Okay, so still, you're telling me that it is so deeply embedded in black America that Democrats are their friends and Republicans are their enemies, despite all the evidence, and it just continues? It's like inherited through mother's milk? Is that basically what you're saying?
Well, a lot of people, it seems to be that way. And I get so frustrated when it comes to President Trump and his accomplishments, because I talk with many black people and they don't believe it all. They don't believe any of it. They say, no, President Obama did that. President Obama started it. And so there's a level of ignorance, and I was guilty of a lot of ignorance myself. I talk about the ignorance even that was maintained while I was getting my education. And it took, you know, disillusionment, soul searching, me becoming a person of faith for me to finally see what the Democrats were doing to black people and other Americans. And now they're sticking it to everyone.
So what is your read in the black community right now? Is there any reason to assume any shift in thinking?
There has been a shift, and it's coming from black men. And the president, his support level, even when he was elected, it was higher among black men than black women. I think he got maybe 8%. And then there was a poll in the fall that he had support from anywhere from 20% to 34% of the black population. So I do believe that blacks are beginning to wake up and see the problems with the Democratic Party. I believe it's harder to deceive blacks today, and that President Trump, maybe some of it has to do with the fact that he's seen as an underdog, and black people can relate to that.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
It is not open to debate that marijuana can cause paranoia and psychosis. And it is not open to debate that psychosis is a huge risk factor for serious violent crime.
A critical look at the media's favorite drug when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Alex Berenson was a reporter for the New York Times, covering many topics, including the drug industry. More than just a reporter, he's a skilled writer, and his successful novels took him out of the reporting business. But he was drawn back into the nonfiction world after a conversation with his wife, a forensic psychiatrist who told him of a gruesome crime committed by a man high on marijuana. Alex had thought the drug harmless, but his wife challenged him, well, to read the research. What he found was stunning, a complete shock, in fact. The results are in Berenson's book with the provocative title, tell your children the truth about marijuana, mental illness, and violence. I read the book cover to cover, and I sum it up as I begin my conversation with Berenson. Marijuana causes psychosis. Psychosis causes violence. Marijuana causes violence. And people who are smoking it, or parents of children who are smoking it, need to know the science, because when they know the science, the use of marijuana drops dramatically, as it did in Britain. How's that for a summary?
That's a very good summary. You read the book, my friend.
Oh, I have read every page of the book, and I must tell you, the fact that a black market has developed in states where marijuana has been legalized was news to me. The fact that there are all these awful crimes cited to the cannabis syndrome that is connected with psychosis. But I want to slow down first. Why would you write this? I know your wife is a psychiatrist. I know she matter-of-factly told you that marijuana is often involved in terrible crimes and mental illness and schizophrenia. And you went on this search. But why would you do this? You're a very successful novelist. Why would Alex Berenson undertake this?
After, you know, Jackie told me this, after my wife told me this, I started to look. And I was pretty skeptical. And the more I read, the more I thought, this is unbelievable. This is a major public health story about a drug that is more and more heavily used, that is becoming legal, that is likely to be legal, fully legal nationally. And nobody knows this connection. It is not open to debate that marijuana can cause paranoia and psychosis. And it is not open to debate that psychosis is a huge risk factor for serious violent crime.
You are going to face the same uphill struggle that those who warned about the connection between cigarette smoking and lung cancer faced 50 years ago. Moreover, you're up against an industry that's making billions, and it is a politically unpopular position to say that marijuana is going to cause more psychosis in the people who are predisposed to it, and breaks among those who have it, as well as violent episodes of horrific nature. You're up against that. Have you already felt that?
Yes, I have. I mean, I've gotten a lot of nonsense on Twitter and, you know, and a lot of disingenuous pushback from the advocacy community. You know what? I know what the science says. I talked to the leading physician scientists on this issue. People have been looking at this for 30 years, and they're all, you know, they're on the same page. And by the way, I've also heard from a lot of people, a lot of parents who have already written me and said, you know, this happened to my child, and I didn't really understand what was going on. Thank you for, thank you for putting this in context for me. I mean, the book's been out 2 days. The op-ed ran, you know, 5 or 6 days ago. I'm shocked by how many people have said this to me, and people who have suffered have said this to me. You know, I don't want to overstate the fact that psychosis and schizophrenia, they're terrible. Not just because they can cause violence. They can cause violence, although most people don't become violent. It increases your risk quite a bit. But we don't want to, you know, stigmatize everybody and say everybody becomes violent. But they are terrible diseases. They cause terrible suffering for the people who have them and for their families.
I want to quote from early in the book. Researchers agree the connection between marijuana and psychosis is not as strong as that between tobacco and lung cancer. The best guess is that adolescent marijuana use raises the risk of schizophrenia between 2 and 6-fold. The great majority of teenagers who use marijuana will not develop the disorder. But your point is, it is a huge risk. I kind of got my own analogy is, if you were indifferent to your children driving after 4 or 5 drinks every night, you might be indifferent to their smoking marijuana. But if you're not indifferent to that, you shouldn't be indifferent to their using dope.
That's exactly right. That's a really good way to look at it. And, you know, and by the way, most people, listen, we know cigarettes cause lung cancer, okay? But most of that risk is towards the end of your life. It's sort of post-55, post-60. If I had to choose between getting lung cancer at 60 and developing schizophrenia, having a psychotic break at 22 and, you know, never getting my life back, there's no question in my mind what I choose.
Let me also go to the killer argument that you make. And I don't mean it literally kills people, but it does end the discussion. If the marijuana lobby is so, quote, certain legalization is not just the right public policy decision, but a moral imperative, why won't they be honest about the risks, close quote? That is an unanswerable question, Alex Berenson.
Well, I think the answer is they want to get it legalized. And I think that, you know, I actually tweeted this a couple of days ago. The most powerful drug is denial. So, you know, the cigarette companies, as late as the 90s were arguing that causation on lung cancer had not been proven. I mean, that was, it was a crazy, crazy place for them to be. But they had money at stake, and they didn't care.
Yeah, I want to read again from page 41. Today, marijuana is far stronger, regularly 20% to 25% THC. At that potency, a single joint can contain more than 100 milligrams of the drug. And regular smokers sometimes coat their joints with near-pure THC oil extract, further increasing the amount of THC. The sharp rise in marijuana's THC content runs contrary to the argument of legalizers that banning drugs encourages dealers to increase their potency because they can then smuggle less of the more concentrated substance. Demand from consumers, not growers or dealers, seems to have driven the move to higher THC marijuana. Users prefer higher THC forms of the drug because they can smoke less and get high more quickly. Smokers want to party and get wasted, a grower told online magazine Slate in a 2013 article. The legalized market has responded to their wishes. You know, if I told people that fentanyl was simply the market responding to people's desire to have opioids, they would acknowledge that. But people won't acknowledge this, Alex.
No, they won't. And, you know, and there's this mythology around marijuana as medicine, which has gotten worse and worse as for-profit companies have come in.
Right.
You know, it's so strange that we pretend that this is not a recreational drug, that this is, you know, alcohol has certain medicinal properties, but we don't say it's medicine. It's not medicine. And marijuana is not medicine. And people want to use it to get high most of the time. There are people out there saying, you know what, my kid is using cannabis. That's okay. I'd rather have him or her use that than alcohol. I mean, that is exactly the wrong message right now with this high THC stuff, especially if your child is in his or her teens. It's a crazy thing to allow.
Go to HughHewitt.com for the entire interview with Alex Berenson. I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up, sports legend Curt Schilling.
Sports media has gone the way of journalism, which is hard left.
Stay tuned for the final segment of the Town Hall Review in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Curt Schilling's baseball career is remarkable. His Game 6 victory over the Yankees in the 2004 American League Championship Series is legendary. That year, the Red Sox unbelievably went on to end the so-called curse and win the World Series. After retiring from baseball, Schilling was hired by ESPN. But the relationship didn't last, as the network did not appreciate his conservative bent. Schilling recently spoke with newly minted Salem host Sebastian Gorka.
Sports coverage, the whole industry in this nation, it's in trouble, isn't it? The last few years.
Yeah.
What's going on, and what's the prognostication? And tell us something about your own personal experience with ESPN, if you wouldn't mind.
It's sports. Sports media has gone the way of journalism, which is hard left. And the hatred of conservatives is palpable. Well, they said, I think there was a survey about six months to a year ago. 86% of the writers in sports media lean left or vote left. And I would argue that probably a significant percentage of athletes by nature are conservatives. You could argue that those people, those writers, have a job they hate, standing in front of conservative millionaires who are young kids and having to ask them questions as if they're on an equal footing, because liberals love to look down on people. So, but no, it's gone left. At ESPN, you know, one of the reasons I was fired was because I was an outspoken conservative. And, you know, I understand. Since then, they've tried to paint it as, what do they use? Islamophobic, homophobic, transphobic, bigot,
right?
Racist, all the other things that go with that. Although, I've never had any of them come back to me with proof of any of it.
Well, they don't need that. It's not about proof. It's about narratives. But as somebody who was there, who was in the middle of sports media as a former sportsman, just explain one thing to me. How do they not get it when their ratings tank and when people don't go to NFL games? Is there not somebody who's, you know, a bean counter who says, guys, shut up and talk about the sports?
Right. they don't care. Seb, I would ask you the same question about CNN.
Right.
Why does CNN continue to shoot itself in the foot, literally, when their ratings are plummeting and they continue to go double down on stupid? I've seen segments on things. Well, I got to see a segment on Trump and Diet Coke once. I mean, that was amazing.
Right.
You know, I mean, and then we got to see, who was it that loved glue in the third grade? We got to see, the stuff that they're doing is not only embarrassing and willfully ignorant, but it's intentional. And that's the dangerous part to me. The Fourth Estate was always supposed to be its own entity, right?
Yes.
Supposed to be unbiased. It was supposed to give you and I a look into the government.
A check on the powerful. It's supposed to be a check on the powerful.
Right. And it's become a tool of the left, period.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of Town Hall Review. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. And sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and radio blogger himself, Dwayne Patterson. That's radio blogger on Twitter. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.